Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Eater Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Well, hello everybody from sunny Florida.
Brian Brushwood.
Reporting for duty right here at Diamond Club Studios, deep in the heart of the 7-acre Schwood, located right on Austin city limits.
And Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Ditto what the last guy said.
Yeah, I'm next to Brian. I don't know.
I'm so focused on what you said, I almost said, and Bryce Brushwood.
Don't start rumors, man.
Once you're on the compound, you're all a Brushwood.
That's we're right, family. That's, right. That's the first thing that happens is you sign this document that changes your legal name.
So I want to jump right into it. This was a story that came up last week, and I saw this, and I want to get your take on it. And Bryce, I didn't even bother sending the link because you're faster than I am at sending emails. Boston Robotics released a commercial for one of their robots to say, hey, you know those scary robots we've been threatening you with? They're now going to be available. You're going to be able to buy one of these. And they put up a commercial, really well-produced commercial showing one of these robots in use. And it's one of the ones we've seen before. And if you want to take a look at this commercial, I want you guys to watch it. I think there might be a Verge, may have had a link directly to the whole thing. And I want to get your take on it. I want to get everybody's take on this because we're now seeing, we're in the future, guys. Robots are for sale.
Okay, all right. This is the Spot Robot, the one that looks like a dog, kind of, with construction equipment. It's animated. I don't know. It looks like maybe 15-20 frames per second, so it looks a little bit cartoonish as
they
it
say
moves.
It goes 3 miles an hour, 90-minute battery.
Navigates challenging terrain.
So now, it is currently traversing its way on top of a pile of trash, now walking down steps at a construction site.
360 okay. Cameras to avoid
obstacles. Oh, this is interesting that they're putting it as people are framing a house. So a bunch of they're framing it like construction equipment. So I guess I wasn't far off. So to what? Okay,
what use is it? It's opening a door, but I don't see it doing.
It's opening a door for its fellow robot person.
But they're not going anywhere.
To go out into the surface of Mars or some crap where it's carrying.
Carrying one cinder block.
Yeah.
Okay.
Crash protection, dynamic reaction. So that's all the, like, you hit it and it stays afloat. Self-rights after it falls.
I mean, this, oh my goodness. Okay, it says it operates in negative 20 Celsius to
45 degrees Celsius.
Apparently it also exists in Jurassic Park as it is now walking through heavy rain.
And all
in
we're
a jungle
seeing...
setting.
It's in a Wes Anderson movie.
And then it goes to a AstroTurf fake set and then walks into a construction guy's house and then lays down
in
evoking
the
image
the
of a dog. Okay.
All right. First off, the robotics is incredible. The movement, the motion, amazing. What's your reactions?
This is... quite possibly the worst ad I've ever seen. If it's meant as an ad, if it's meant to be played in the background during a keynote, then that's fine. But in the advertising world, they talk about the difference between features and benefits. This was quite literally nothing but features and no benefits. The closest they got is they depicted for about 4 seconds a spot carrying a single cinder block. This may be this, if this is truly intended as an ad, it is the, think of the iPhone launch where they say, wouldn't you love to connect with your loved ones? Wouldn't you love to get your email? Wouldn't you love to have a map of everything? Those are all benefits that happen to use the iPhone. I hate this beyond words, Andrew.
Well, what's annoying, I'm on the website here for it and it has some of the applications for it and most of it is sensors and camera work, stuff that is not carrying things, but that doesn't come across in the ad. It's just walking left to right in the ad, and there's not even like a metaphor of it doing these like remotely inspecting facilities or in, you know, creating digital twins of construction sites or, you know, navigating dangerous situations remotely. Well,
yeah, I think right now it is primarily on their website listed as a camera that walks around. Would you like a camera that walks around and shows you things when you're not there? I assume it is all, you know, wired up so you can watch whatever it is on your phone. The big thing here, though, is that ad to me screams somebody wants to buy these things that have already been viral for years, right? That is an announcement that there is a thing for sale. The fact that it does not list a price either outwardly on its website or in the commercial tells me that this is primarily a, if you have to ask, you can't afford it kind of luxury.
And on top of that, it implies to me that they don't actually want to sell very many of these. Like, if the worst thing you want is a bunch of people buying it, and then you got to make a whole bunch of them, especially if you have, let's say, a Generation 2 coming down the pipeline. So in that case, I might forgive this bad of an advertisement, but the fact that something so awful
Brian, I would think of it, this is more of a visual press release than it is an ad. This is not like the Steve Jobs, your entire record collection in your pocket. This is effectively just a visual version of something that would have come through the fax machine in bold type print up top. Boston Dynamics announces that this is for sale. Please contact sales department.
I mean, okay, but even it's worse than everything. It's the worst Boston Dynamics video we've seen all the way back to and including the very first one, the one that put it on the radar for all of us. Like, if anything, just do a supercut of showing us how far Boston Dynamics has come for 30 seconds and then say, now finally, for sale, spot. That
I think
would
you
be better
should just make it like, remember that scene in RoboCop when RoboCop keeps kind of waking up periodically and they're like, when they're drunk at the Christmas party and they're like kissing them and everything. I feel like that should be the ad. And then it just spot. I don't know. Email us. That should be their slogan.
You know what?
Email us if you're rich.
That'd be better. That'd be better in my book. Also, I assume you listen to the same podcast I listen to where they mentioned that kiss scene was totally improv, all of the party stuff.
No, I have not. I have not. No.
It's an amazing podcast. It's in your feed and you will figure out which one it is.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
I think they build amazing stuff. I think this spot is an amazing piece of robotics and what it's capable of doing. But it is that, you know, there's, and I don't want to accuse them of this, but there is, in the technology world, you sometimes get, you get entrepreneurs or people who are trying to solve a problem, and then you get sometimes engineering solutions where engineers have a technology they're trying to find an application. And we can all imagine that it's not hard for any of us to imagine that 10 years from now, we could see a lot of robotics being used for a lot of things and doing cool stuff. But it's just this first commercial where, like, the only piece of work we see one doing is literally carrying a cinder block to I don't know what, to, like, go throw it through the construction manager's window because they want a break. It just is a little confusing to me. And I think nobody here is doubting, you know, there's no future to robotics. But it is this sort of weird, like, what could this do that I couldn't do with, like, an RC car, you know?
Yeah, there's a million things that you could do for, like, the camera stuff. I guess I could see, depending on what the price tag is on it, like, if you are just a contractor, right, and you are working on stuff or you're, like, building houses, to have a thing that's just kind of knowing where you are and is following you with just a bunch of tools or other things that you would need that would be annoying to drag, like, a gigantic toolbox around, that I could see. But it doesn't look like that's the market that they're pitching this to, because if they were, they'd list a price. What they are looking for are gigantic companies to call them and be like, yes, we'd like to order a fleet. Like, I feel like they're only taking orders for 20 units and above.
And we don't really know. We know that it walks and has this scanning thing, and I'm sure we can dig into the site and find out more. Like, does it do a predetermined route? What's going on? You know, what's what else there? And, you know, one of the things that I had this epiphany with my little robot vacuum cleaner was the idea that, and not again, epiphany other people had realized, and I finally caught on to what the trend was, special purpose robotics are still have a very are a great idea. You know, build a thing that just vacuums your floor. Build a thing that just mops the floor. You know, there's build a better thing to maybe clean dishes. And, you know, the all-purpose robot will happen maybe one day, but small focus on trying to do everything's hard, but focus on small tasks and you can do something cool. So,
well, and again, it's I'm deeply confused just whether or not they actually intended to sell anything. And if they did, they did a very poor job, but maybe that's what they wanted to do because they only have so much capacity.
Here's what I do know. Somebody got paid a lot of money to make that commercial, and they were very confused about exactly what they were doing beyond watching the cool robot go. And so somebody got to do a bunch of really cool storyboards for what it was, but I'm sure that there was a very weird meeting wherein they were like, hey, what are we selling here? Like, what do you want to, who do you want to sell it to? And they were like, just make a thing. We trust you guys. Go.
Yeah. It feels like a group of engineers who become company managers in a room with some, you know, advertising people saying, yeah, we see these app. We think this, and not a lot of deep market sort of research. I could be totally wrong. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the thing, is that also it's an awkward hybrid, because normally if it's something that's inside, if it's business to business effectively, right, like you are selling just a fleet to another gigantic construction conglomerate or something like that, or as security robots, you know, to wander around some corporate campus, then you don't really need a fancy ad. Like, you just need like it. Look, watch us, a fairly plain shot of it doing a thing. You make an ad like that if you want to sell to the consumer and they don't have anything listed there. So it just is an awkward fit for a company that I think is still trying to find exactly what it exists for, besides making everybody scared that there's going to be a robot revolution and we're going to lose.
Yeah. Well, you know, one revolution we never have to worry about losing is Bryce's future as a stock photography model.
That's right. I moonlight as a Shutterstock model.
Speaking of which, we were talking about this before the show. Could you just give me the perplexed engineer look? There it is. Yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
Oh, it's just a segment I like to call for the audio listeners.
I'm sorry, Bryce. I just got a message here. There's a website called generated.photos where they've taken that idea of faces have never existed before, and they now have a library of 100,000 headshots of totally computer-generated faces. And I guess we're not that far away from typing in perplexed engineer and getting perplexed engineer.
Oh, my goodness. In the advertisement, it says no licenses, no releases, hassles,
no
releases. Wow.
That's great. Oh, and you can, there's like a drop down. So you can actually pick their ethnicity, their age, gender, their mood. This is.
Well, on the one hand, we're amazed because of the fidelity. But on the other hand, isn't this character creation at the beginning of Fallout? isn't this the same thing?
Oh, no, but now you get to do it for stock images. Now you get to create these photorealistic versions.
Oh, my God. I want to do is see this.
Wait, is this like bankruptcy? Is this basically like Black, was it Monday? Black Monday or Black Friday with the stock market collapse?
I think there was one of each.
One of each. Yeah, it's that for pretty people. Like, congratulations. The bottom just fell out on attractiveness.
I just want to see this on Monster Factory.
Yeah.
That's some scary boys.
As far as what separates this from, let's say, like in game design, choosing characters is that those often use, they're like 30 different presets or something like that that have a bunch of combinations. This is literally saying, okay, grab 1,000 images of people with dark skin, 1,000 people with this sort of hairstyle, and generate from there entirely new, you know, never existing before. So, you know, there's going to be infinite, because it's literally breaking down the process of an image, you know, a face itself.
Dear. So this is I don't know if their web tool is actually working right now. They have a link to this Google Drive, and this is the very first image in the very first folder of a
it's not great
giving pause.
Right.
Face.
All right. So yeah, it's a dude who's squinting, but one eye is squinting a lot more than the other one.
It's definitely a person mid-stroke right now.
Yeah.
No. Look under the caption. It says the Rihanna blink.
Yeah, it is. That is Rihanna trying to wink. So wait, Bryce, what mood do you think that first dude is in? What mood would that be?
Oh, it's an incredibly big mood, that's for sure.
Bryce, did I hear you correctly? Did you say
how they dropped out?
did you say that this is the very first image in the entire catalog? It's image 000000001.jpg.
Yeah. Folder 10,000, which is the first one, and then that's right, 000001.jpg.
Oh, this is garbage. These are all go to the next one, and because sure. It looks
minute.
Like the
Can
hair was
be
messed
our
up.
New album art? I know we haven't changed our album art in forever, but I feel like that's our new mascot.
Okay, look at the right. Look at her hair. It's garbage.
There. Yeah, hair is always a big thing for like if you use any of the other like generate face things, hair and clothes, or when there are multiple people, or even just the edges of images are still pretty rough.
Also, she's clearly a vampire. Go back. Look at that. She's a mono vampire.
Some of us have snaggletooth too. snaggletooth solidarity.
Yeah, but that ends in a very sharp point.
She's not real, Bryce. Stop defending her.
So okay, this guy looks okay.
That looks like an average dude.
Yeah. Let's
see. Finally, average is available to the masses. What? Oh, hold on. Whoa, I love Doctor Who. Yeah. Tom Baker.
this is very, if you're not listening, go check out youtube.com/bbpedia videos where we have the video version of the show.
What is the site, by the way? In case people want to
generated.photos.
Generated.photos. Okay.
Yeah. So there's not, this tool that they're describing doesn't exist yet, Andrew, or is it not like public, like a public thing?
That might be a way to search through stuff. So, you know, basically they're saying they put like, they created like 100,000 of these images. And, you know, the point is that this is the starting point. This is where it begins. And there are, you just go through there, like in that collection of images right off the bat, we saw a little bit that looked a little uncanny. We saw some defects, but there's some totally usable ones in there, and it's a totally free library of images. Yeah. And where does it go from here? You know, what is Gen 2, Gen 3, Gen 4 of this stuff?
So let me ask you a question. So we've seen music, for example, that there is an increasing element of you know, copyright claims on like, oh, this is a melody or a feel that has been part of this music. Is there ever going to be a point where if you can prove that your face was part of the infinite goulash that went into one of these generated images, that you could assert some kind of copyright on it?
That conversation has come up relating to other sorts of content that certain groups or individuals I've talked to that have wanted to use that to build, you know, a neural net. And that's going to be a thing that I'm sure we will see a case. We're going to see something at some point, particularly because as people become more cognizant of how our images are being used. Like, you know, they just had a contractor working for Google just got into a bit of heat because they're looking for homeless people to do facial scans, trying to solve a problem, which is that a lot of data sets that people of color are often underrepresented. So some group said, well, you know, got contracted to get more, you know, persons of color and facial scans, and were apparently going to homeless people and not fully divulging, you know, when they were looking at the Men in Black device, what this was for.
Yeah.
So, Will somebody make a lawsuit about this and we'll get some sort of case law to decide it? Probably.
So I have a real world case that this right now, as is, as flawed as it is, would be perfect for. There was a case, I think there was a campaign in New York where somebody, it was an anti-rape campaign. And so they bought a whole bunch of stock images and they said, you know, something like, hey man, not all rapists look creepy. The face of rape, something or other. Yeah. And then meanwhile, this is a model who just showed up and did a gig, and then yeah. their face is being paraded around on taxi cabs all over as the new face of rape.
There's another story, maybe it's not to the same degree of severity, but there's another story of a woman who did a similar thing. She went just for a stock model, you know, session and got a few hundred bucks. But then the company that owns those photos went and sold those photos. And so this one woman became the face of, I want to say it was like a hemorrhoid cream. And it was everywhere, and it was this huge marketing thing, and it was her, and she couldn't do anything about it.
Well, you know what? If we're going to do kind of that middle ground, I remember Jeff Cannata had done one of these generic photo shoots of him holding an arrow pointing to a thing, like, oh, look at this over here. And somebody had grabbed it from a stock photo thing, and what he was pointing at was something pseudoscientific or that it was that fringe thing. It's just like homeopathic remedies that'll cure anything. And he's just like, no, I don't agree with this. This is a stock image that they bought or whatever. Seems to me like if you know that what you're selling is on the wrong side of science, maybe you would definitely prefer to get these non-real people.
I mean, it would seem like if you were on the wrong side of wanting to pay any money, you would want to use all these free people that now are freely available and looked literally indistinguishable, except for that lady. Oh, my God.
Oh, geez,
from actual human beings.
This kid's got a bullet hole in his head. Or is that a tiny little head coming out of his head?
There's it kind of touched back. A story we talked about before was that I think it was some researchers from MIT. They released a story talking about the hipster effect, that anti-conformists are way more conforming than they realize. You know, the ones who, you know, that if you think that you're anti-conformist, you're actually much more likely to try to conform to something. And they had a photo of an article ran with that, with a photo of a hipster. And a guy wrote, said, hey, how dare you use my photo? This is slander, blah, 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 insulting. And then turned out it was a Getty stock image of some totally different other guy.
That's hilarious.
Oh, wow.
Let's see if we can find his.
Although, by the way, I've met that dude 1,000 times.
Yeah.
I feel like I've met... That dude is always a friend of mine's boyfriend.
He wrote, your lack of basic journalistic ethics in both the manner in which you report this uncredited nonsense and the slanderous unnecessary use of my picture without permission demands a response and, of course, pursuing legal action.
Oh, my God.
Oh, that's amazing.
And that was the irony, of course, was the article was about how hipsters don't realize how conformist they are. And follow-up article, evidence.
I'll tell you what, man. We enter a world where... It's worth the extra money.
Sorry,
we're
Ryan
already
talking
in a world.
The beards confuse me. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
We're already in a world where, despite the ridiculous extra expense, it makes sense to buy stock images because you at least know that they're clean IP and that they all have releases. But even then, you have the troublesome possibility that somebody will dispute the release after the fact based on how you're using it, no matter how many levels of insistence or paperwork on there. At least you have 100% clean IP with a 100%, like, all of a sudden the logical thing becomes to do nothing but digitally created people, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's somebody who signs away a release, it generally won't get very far if it's used in the context of it. So you're sort of safe to use those, but the cost, I mean, that's the thing, is like, you look at what it costs to use a Getty image. And these things are ridiculously expensive for this stuff. And understandable.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of work that goes on behalf of photographers, and don't want to downplay that. But, you know,
it's over for you, symmetrical faced hoes. That's it. All hail those with kind of weird, droopy eyes. We will remain king. No more for you and your high priced, attractive looking faces to sell our dish soap. Now we have the computers do it. They will be our saviors in the same way that you, dear listeners, are our saviors when you head to patreon.com/weirdthings. That is where you can support this very program, and indeed you have for oh so many weeks, months, and years. We thank you for making sure that we continue to do this very program. patreon.com/weirdthings. Head on over there right now.
So There was a paper published in the FEMS Microbiology Ecology Journal, I assume. Microbiologist Jose Lopez, a professor at Nova Southeastern University.
Hey!
Right next to where Justin grew up, and his colleague W. Raquel Piazzotti and Alexander Rosada from the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro, they've got a very interesting idea on how to deal with the contamination of Mars. Their plan is, because that's a big thing, planetary protection, how do you prevent contamination? They've got a solution. You ready for this?
All right. And by the way, we've talked about this before. I know you guys haven't read it, but the Mars trilogy by Kim Stanley Robinson, there's the reds and the greens. The greens say contaminate everything, make it a paradise that's lush with life. The reds say, no, the geology is invaluable. You're going to corrupt all of that. It's a clever inversion of the traditional environmentalist debate. So what is their take on this?
They're like, contaminate away. They say, listen, once you put people there, that's going to get contaminated. And the idea that we're going to try to protect or prevent this sort of thing from happening is pointless. We might as well go contaminate and spread our microbes everywhere, because we should be consider it not accidental, but inevitable. The idea, it's going to happen no matter what. Either we never go there ever, or we do. And what's the point?
100% agree with this. I feel like there is a decent chance that there's probably not completely zero, but let's say for sake of discussion that there is no double helix DNA that is not within 10,000 miles of Earth, then there should be, and it should be everywhere, and we should get it out there so that some generation, millennia, eons hence, can at least grow and possibly create intelligence again, even if humans wipe themselves out.
You get into, and their suggestion is, if we ever want to, change Mars, live on Mars, turn the environment around, then we're going to have to do this. And it gets into a fundamental question. And that's what the point you brought up, Kim Stanley Robinson brought up, between the reds and the greens, is that you have some people like, no, it's wrong to do that. And it comes down to, like, grand scheme of things, what is wrong? Is it wrong that we want to explore and we want to go live on this other planet and have people living there? From some point of view, that is.
Think about this. Here's a fun one. Is it wrong to take a mostly developed planetoid and on purpose take another planetoid, even though this first planetoid is let's say, two-thirds developed, and take this other one that smashes into it, liquefies everything, and undoes all of the progress so far? Congratulations. I just described how we got a moon. Very likely the instrument that continues to do a gravity sweep and allows life to exist on planet Earth.
Well, and we've had, from that impact and other impacts, we've had pieces of Earth that have made their way to Mars and vice versa. There's been the potential for cross-contamination has been happening for a billion years between the two planets. And I've said this before, I'll say this again. We think about the idea that, like, oh, if we found life on Mars, it'll be the biggest discovery. It'll be one of the biggest discoveries in science ever. Theoretically, but the thing is we will get, it won't be like, we know now for sure there's life on Mars. If we find microbes on Mars, the first step people are going to, we think we had it, but we may have brought it here and it may have contaminated. That'll be the first question we ask. So it won't be like, yay, there's life on Mars. We won't know for sure. Then if we reduce that, it might be, yeah, but you know what? We think these microbes may have been carried by asteroids from Earth, and maybe we contaminated earlier on. So it's still cool, but it's not as cool as it coming from there. There will be all these degrees, and anywhere in our solar system that we find microbial life, those will be the questions we're going to ask, which will sort of like put water on the whole, we found life elsewhere, unless it's really complex multicellular. So,
I don't know that you flatly said whether you're on board with this analysis or not. Are you on board with it?
Oh, contaminating it, putting microbes, like just defacing this beautiful, pristine, completely dead world that is doing absolutely nothing. 100%. 100%.
I mean, I'll tell you what, I don't even call it contaminated. I call it getting it in the shower, washing its hair, getting a haircut, and getting a goddamn job and doing something with its life. Old shaggy Mars, shambling around the solar system, not doing anything. Oh, is there water? Well, it better find some water and some soap while it's at it. Filthy hippie Mars.
I was here back when this was red rocks as far as the eye can see, and then along came Earthy Appleseed, and he scattered his life dust all over this place, just like he did all the way out of the solar system and beyond. I'll tell you what.
Screw you, Dr. Manhattan.
We we're never going to have an agreement to what is the right thing to do, because there's going to be different goals towards that. And you, the question you would ask, you know, the people who are staunch planetary protectionists is, at what point would you think colonization is okay? At what point would you say there is no risk of contamination? The answer is you could never say there's no risk of contamination. So you have to say either we never colonize, or you have to say after we've done X amount of research with robot probes or something. But if there's not an incentive to do that research, but there's an incentive to send people there, it gets into this, I want it to be this way, the other groups, I want it to be that way. And I don't know if there's ever a compromise there.
Do you think that there's any value in at least the idea that once we go there, or once we contaminate it to whatever degree we consider the word contaminating it, that there's no undoing it, or like that the pristineness of Mars now we can't replicate again?
Yes, that is an argument. But I have a hard time. It's that tree falls in the wood and there's nobody to hear it. It's just like, you know, it's like these trees deserve to fall in peace without anyone hearing them.
No, but like if we had a way to, like, because we haven't, if we had a way to get at Mars and, you know, get even more data before, you know, Earth intervention, wouldn't that be scientifically, I don't know.
What we're at now is a point of we don't know, and you don't want to ruin these mystery boxes before we could fully understand what is in them. But that is always an untenable position, right? Because they don't contain any, you know, known knowledge. They contain possibly something that we would have an idea of long down the road, that maybe we would say, oh, geez, it would have been nice if we would have kept the bleep blob. But ultimately, our point on Mars is survival. Our point on Mars is colonization. Well, and if we're going to do that, then that's what just needs to happen.
And there is, I think Bryce is getting at sort of a utilitarian argument where it's like, there is a precious resource called an untainted planet. And as far as we know, we don't have very many of them. And do we want to go from some number of them to one less immediately? And I think that all of us here would probably agree that, first of all, it's a fantasy. The moment we drop Voyager on there, despite our best efforts to sterilize everything, or sorry, not Voyager, Viking, then it was already over. But also, I would give the counter-utilitarian argument of saying, yes, there's some amount of detriment to the complete loss. We will never have a pristine Mars again, but the benefit of two Earths is so great that it merits the moral justification to intentionally corrupt the pristine Mars.
Even if that's just, you know, the second to next thing that we do. I mean, I don't know what the first thing we would do with the pristine Mars, but ideally there would be some sort of evidence, you know, continued and deeper evidence gathering of it looks like before we begin. And like, yeah, let's do it when it's time to do it. But
this is played out in the Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars trilogy, where what happens is the side that you're representing right now, that is the geologist side. And they're super annoyed that it's like so much data we could have had and now we can't do it. And what happens is as humans take over more areas, geologists are like, well, it's not perfect, but they go higher and higher. Keep in mind, Olympus Mons is so high up that it creates a double horizon. If you go far enough, you see the actual horizon of the curvature of the planet. Then you see the caldera of a volcano pop above it. So the idea is, like, at that point, even though down below however many feet there's some kind of breathable atmosphere, above it, it still might as well be completely untouched, in space, sterilized, original stuff. So the important thing is to remember it won't all happen at once. It'll be an infection that spreads, and we can study ahead of that wave of infection as we go forward.
I think that, you know, we we certainly have, you know, there's the argument like, we don't want to bring our problems there. And I'm like, well, sure, obviously, but we're better at a lot of things now than we were before. And, you know, you take like in the United States, we have, if you look at a map of the part, amount of the United States that is national parks and forests and stuff, it's incredible. You know, we have an incredibly large part of our country that we have said, don't develop. Every now and then we do land swaps, things like that. But generally those things have increased, not decreased. And we've actually taken back lands. We've actually probably reached peak farmland and we've been taking back and reclaiming lands. And, you know, and their arguments could be like, it's coming to the expense of other countries, perhaps, but also increases in agriculture. You know, there are more trees today in the U.S. than there were before. And it's not solely because we're just importing them, whatever. You put a value on that. As you become a wealthier economy, you put a value in that kind of preservation. And I would think that, you know, we go to Mars, we're going to not decide that everything's going to be an Applebee's there. You know, we're going to have large parts of it there, but microbial contamination, microbes don't know where they can or cannot go. And I do think that, like, yeah, I understand the sense of loss of, let's say we found a big ecosystem underground there that had bacteria and our bacteria get along and do something to it. There's that risk. But, you know, I look at it, the choice between the exciting opportunity of, if we can inhabit another planet and we can have, and not even Earth too, just a different world in our solar system filled with humans doing their own kind of thing and their own culture and their own thing. I mean, that just sounds exciting to me.
Yeah. And I'm not saying let's not do it. Like, just to be clear, I'm not saying let's never do it. I'm just saying there's probably a phase we can do with this thing that we have first and then.
Well, no, I'm saying lead with the Arby's. Lead with the Arby's, and we're going to terraform the planet with wicked beef gassers. That's how we're going to do it.
Meet Mount Olympus.
We're cutting, Bryce, sweet your point,
beef gassers.
Your Earth first and last point. The question is that how do we say there's a moratorium that for the next 20 years we only do robotic exploration and we do this?
I don't know. I wouldn't know what we would do with it at all, but we've never made it out there yet with a human.
Well, and
either,
also, but also it's like, all right, look, so let's say we did. Let's say we put on a 20-year moratorium. Who's going to be out there playing Coast Guard when China shoots off a rocket looking to colonize? Who's going to be the Coast Guard when Russia does it? Who's going to be the Coast Guard when Zuckerberg and his boys get drunk and charter a SpaceX rocket because they want to go skinny dipping on Mars? Like, this is just, as soon as we have the ability to get there, if we have the ability to guard it, we have the ability to get there, and that's just going to be a wrap. Like, as soon as that bridge is built, everybody will be there, and there's going to be very, unless we get ironclad understanding, then, yeah, it's going to be very hard.
So, okay, try this on for size. The moon. We know for sure, let's say, for sake of discussion, we know for a fact there's not a single living thing on the moon. Let's say there's a lava tube with the most complex, gorgeous crystal lattice formation, snowflakes times a billion, that took, let's say 13.5 million years to form. All of it made out of, for sake of discussion, something valuable, helium-3 or whatever. That doesn't make sense because it's probably not
solid.
We're
going with it. It's fine.
But we get photos of it, and then we start harvesting it. Do you have a campaign to stop the harvesting of the most valuable thing in the world because it happens to be arranged in a very visually attractive pattern that took a very long time to make?
Well, we've had sort of examples of that, like these crystal caves in Thailand and places like that where they find these the largest quartz crystals we've ever seen, these formations that are like incredible, and they won't even tell people where they are. Like the tallest tree in the United States is a secret because we want to protect it.
As
from
is
being
the oldest
down.
Tree.
Yeah. And it's like, and my question is, what makes the tallest tree in America that much better than the 50th tallest tree, you know, or the 40th oldest tree, you know? And it's like, why is that worthy of protection? And they're not, it's bigger, fend for itself.
Man, it's hard because emotionally I get it, but logically I can't even get close to justifying it. It's like that stuff can save lives and power cities and enable people to go see spelling bees of their grandchildren and
cutting down the trees.
Let me throw a opposite to Justin's suggestion about, you know, the, hey, you know, who's going to, if you have the ability, who's going to stop you?
Yeah.
I'm more concerned about, let's say SpaceX says, hey, we have the capability. We can do a human mission in 2026. All the other countries that are nowhere near close to being able to get to Mars, or even, you know, parts of an agency here that are opposed to this, start screaming planetary protection as a way to stop them. Not so much because they're worried about planetary protection, but they just don't want the don't want that to be first.
I don't doubt that all of these are coming. These are all issues that we are going to face the more that this stops becoming a science experiment and starts becoming industry. Like, once you start, you know, there's that old saying that, like, he who controls time controls the world. And that was, like, about, like, our modern time system being set by the British, right? Who knows? I mean, if you control the rockets, you control space. You control all of that industry. You control the lifeline between planets. Like, as this moves away from an engineering problem and into who's going to control the railroads, not whether or not we can build them at that scale, man, we are going to see titanic conflicts, the likes of which we have only dreamt about.
Yeah, I think that we're going to see some people that if it was their group that was going to be doing the exploration, they would assure us that they have the proper planetary protection protocols in place. But if it's another group that's doing it, they will use that as an excuse to say, oh, no, you can't do this.
You don't have the proper licensing, sir.
And in so many ways, we have already seen this. And it's really weird to sort of gird our loins and get ready for the next version of the invasion of the new world, or the next westward expansion, and the next railroad barons, and the next everything. That's crazy.
I think I got the solution is that we, like, get a bunch of dirty underwear from Dragon Con and we put it on a rocket and we just preemptively contaminate Mars. I'm like, it's too late. It's been done.
Yeah. Sorry. We tossed the laundry bomb.
It's like the Genesis probe from, you know, Star Trek. You know?
Yeah. We've colonized Mars one skid mark at a time.
Jeez.
All right. Let's go to picks.
Hey, man, I had a pick, but then I started reading another book. Can I do two picks?
No.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't think so. You know. One pick is, I've mentioned before, the works of Ryan Holiday, who wrote Ego is the Enemy, The Obstacle is the Way. He wrote Trust Me, I'm Lying, and I'm about halfway through his Stillness is the Key, which is, if there's sort of a trend, it's like he talks about kind of a primer on Stoicism with The Obstacle is the Way. He talks about, you know, getting out of your head and the importance of it to getting ahead in life, because you're not, you know, ego is the enemy. And Stillness is the Key is the more focused on the practical tools to get to that state of bliss so that you can achieve peak performance and stuff. I've enjoyed it, but I stumbled across another book, and I don't know when it came out, but it's by Peter Boghossian and James Lindsay, called How to Have Impossible Conversations. And it's fantastic. I'm only like a couple hours into it, but I'm blown away. They are practical guidelines and rules in this increasingly fractious environment where we could barely have a conversation at Thanksgiving about how to have conversations with people who believe fundamentally different things from what you believe, who probably will view your motives with hostility, and ways that you can make sure to have a productive conversation. Things that some of us do intuitively, and other people, it'll be kind of a light bulb moment. Many of us try to deliver a message where it's our job to tell you, no, the environment's dying, you need to stop it, or whatever. And then they're like, when they're asking questions, it's like, why deliver the message? Why are you not hearing it? Likewise, he talks about the importance of treating whoever it is you're talking about as a partner. And so, as you do with many partnerships, you sort of ask, where are we headed with this? What are we hoping to get out of this? And he mentions, like, there are visible signs that you could tell when somebody's shutting down. There are visible signs. There are things people say that mean, I don't feel like you're hearing me. And there are things you could do to correct that. It is a delightful guide to communication. I'm probably going to read it multiple times. So far, it's really, really great.
Man, that sounds great, because I walk away so many times, mainly from this podcast, going like, why was I trying to force this on everybody? Why was I trying to push this out there? And I just, I'm like, what? I'm still that guy, you know, trying to prove something I don't need to. So well, I need
and,
to read
and,
this.
And in fact, I'm just as guilty as I think both of us would agree with each other. There are times that I'm like, no, you're not listening. You're not listening. And of course, what this book does is give you the tools to notice when you fall. It identifies the pitfalls and the traps and gives you the tools to notice when you're falling into them and ways to set boundaries at the beginning so that both of you could guide to a delightful conversation, including knowing when to tap out. He kind of says, these are the type of things people say that really indicates that you're not going to get anywhere productive after this point. I highly recommend using these off ramps, these exits. I'm really digging it.
I'll check that out.
There's definitely, that was part of my journalism training, the reporter training that I think ultimately has affected me the most in my real life, is understanding that, like, when you have a limited amount of time to talk to a stranger, specifically a stranger that oftentimes are under duress, you need to completely remove yourself and your ego from a conversation. And you need to read social cues really well, because your job depends on being able to connect with somebody and find out if there is a negotiable point in which there is information that they would like to get out there into the general public. Like, that it's high stakes version of, you can't leave, no good reporter leaves a conversation with a, oh, screw you, unless it's like a power play kind of thing. That you're trying to get past a barrier of authority. But that's fascinating. I got to read it.
I'm only in the first part. He divides it into sort of beginner, intermediate, and expert level stuff. And he says a lot of you, and I'm sure he says this for book readers who can kind of skip over, he says a lot of you are going to want to skip forward to intermediate, perceiving that all the beginner stuff is too basic for you. Strongly encourage, like, there's going to be something in there that you're going to discover that you've missed from the beginning.
Yeah. So in, like, journalism school, do they teach you that, like, do that, but then just run right to Twitter to, like, you know, get angry
yes.
at everybody?
Please make sure that you only put it on a website that you have no control over and don't get paid for in advance of your crumbling, terrible paywall that your awful centuries-old media company is putting up. Which, by the way, the New York Times advertising themselves as independent journalism. Support independent journalism. Independent of what? You're the paper of record. All right, whatever.
Independent of profit.
Yeah. Hey, I got a newsworthy little pick for you.
Uh-oh.
So there have been a lot of, in the last 72 hours even, stories about China. And capping it off, there is... big story about the NBA in China, big story about Blizzard in China, and that we can have another conversation where we go into those. But, I mean, I don't know if I have in my life witnessed the kind of run comedically that South Park has had. We are decades into it, and the episode that they ran last week called Banned in China, B-A-N-D in China, is fearless, hilarious, points out the hypocrisies that exist, like, in so many different facets. It is an institution that I don't know if it can ever get the amount of credit that it deserves. Hell, in this episode, which, by the way, is right now on the Comedy Central website, and at least today, when I watched it, had no ads. I suspect because companies might not be interested in advertising on something that is now literally banned in China. But it is just remarkable. Very funny. And I think very, very prescient considering where we are in our modern culture.
I can't wait to watch that. And you know, you guys don't have to know how happy I am this conversation is finally out there from my rants and Justin, my texts and stuff to you about, like, why isn't this a topic like 5 years ago, you know? And now I'm so glad this is now a discussion. And so, because it's just kind of
important. I mean, look, I knew the moment I knew that stuff was for real on the, like, when China pulls your card, it's serious, is when a friend of ours had to have his sad face on the New York Times op-ed page.
Because he recognized that a certain country existed.
Because he made mention, Dare made mention that a company that he worked for, you know, had a connection. And it's like, man, that when that was quick and proactive. Like it was, you know, when and now we're just seeing it more. We're just seeing that on a larger level in all these other stories. But again, in terms of satire, Jesus. I don't know if anything will be recreated at the longevity and scale that South Park has. There's a joke in that episode where a movie producer or a record producer is trying to talk to the boys about how they're going to make a biopic for their band. And they make some suggestion, and the record executive says, "Oh, come on, what are you boys from the 90s?" And there's just an uncomfortable look between all of them, just signifying that, yes, I mean, these guys have been doing this since what, 97, 98?
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it was 95. No, 96.
97.
Okay.
Maybe the Spirit of
Christmas. Yeah, Spirit of Christmas, I guess, is what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, it's crazy that they, I mean, I'm assuming that they're still doing their, you know, 6-day turnaround on this show. It's crazy. Are they still doing the, like, season-long stories? Because that's when I tapped out a few years ago.
Yeah, I have not seen anything else from this season, but the episode revolves heavily around what I assume is a season-long arc of Randy becoming a pot farmer.
I got to pick. I've been rewatching this. I'm almost done rewatching this, but because Righteous Gemstones has been really good and Succession has been really good, I've just been in the HBO library again and almost finished rewatching Veep, which is a pinnacle of comedy, legitimately one of the best comedies maybe ever. And it's dense, but it doesn't feel too fast. It doesn't feel too heavy. It has confidence. Like that's the really good thing about it, is that it has confidence in all of its jokes. So that there's never like this big like stop. Like we just did a big joke. We need to stop and let everyone like it just keeps going. And even, you know, even with Iannucci, the creator and the original showrunner, kind of leaving a few years ago, or, you know, after for the last, what, two or three seasons?
Two seasons, I believe, yeah.
It feels invisible when you binge it all. There's, I guess, goofiness, right? It kind of starts off feeling a little more realistic than where it ends up. But I think the fact that the show was running from what, 2012 up until last year, politically kind of makes it have to exaggerate a little bit more. But also Veep has a lot of good China bits.
I mean the last season, mm-hmm, like leans heavily and it gets dark. Like Veep, just an absolute masterpiece. Like that is when, in a sea of really terrible political comedy, and oh my God, have we had terrible political comedy over the past, I would say we're into a decade of political comedy not being good through Obama and not being in any way, shockingly getting worse, going from toothless to awful in the Trump administration. The lone bright spot, just proving that everybody indeed is bad and it is not impossible, is Veep. Mm-hmm.
I think that show is really well done, but there was a change in the writing in the way they featured their antagonist after the last election, though.
Yeah.
There was a shift in that. You notice, like in Parks and Rec too, which another show I love, but you sort of like, oh wow, there's this. They would have done it differently now because of where they're going, but both amazing shows.
Yeah.
All right, my pick, and I want to avoid any kind of controversial thing here, and I'll just kind of go right down the marrow. I'm going to recommend a comic book movie that's out. It's called The Joker. I don't know if you guys saw this, because, you know, DC movies just you know, maybe don't get as attention as Marvel, but I think that I want to champion this movie so it gets some attention, because frankly, I hope people see it. You know, it's a smaller film as far as, you know,
my goodness, like just looking at the poster and remembering that just the cinematography, it's so well executed.
I love this movie. I really, really enjoyed it. And I know there's a lot of conversations about the movie, and everybody, you're all right. Everybody's
also
right.
I'm enjoying the conversations about the movie too. It's like, it's the gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah. I'm a Scorsese fan, and the films that were that influenced it. You know, I saw King of Comedy years ago and loved that. Loved the stuff like that, and Taxi Driver. All of these things are great and they're neat and they have their thing. And this is a film that we would be having the controversy in 2019 would be over a movie about a DC villain. And part of it is whatever sort of, I don't know, philosophical problems people may have or whatever with it. Fine. But also like, does it borrow too much from Scorsese or this or that?
Yeah.
What a great conversation to have.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're in a very interesting age in film criticism, and I have not seen the movie, so this is just kind of a meta observation, that we almost don't want to have the deep conversation piece movies anymore, and maybe it's social media that, like, the movie gets screened for critics 2 weeks ahead of when we see it, but yet all the critics are going to Twitter, and now it becomes a mini story about what the critics are saying. And now there's, you know, we now battle on like, oh, okay, well, like, is there a divide between the public and the critics and yada, yada, yada. But it's like, I kind of feel like throughout most of my childhood and where I loved movies, hell, why I love the internet, because the internet was the place where I could have or watch the conversations about movies that were worth having conversations over. And now that's like a controversial or a weird thing that people are like, oh, I hated this movie. I love this movie. It's like, no, the best ones to talk about were always the most controversial.
I like that there was the criticism was like, oh, these comic book movies with their superpowers and their special effects and stuff. I like good character driven dramas. Guess what? Now we have a really excellent character-driven, you know, drama that's set in the superhero universe, and some people still aren't happy. And I think, you know, I think fans liked it. I liked it. I think the reaction to this has been great, and it shows you that there is an appetite out there for many different kinds of storytelling.
So. Yeah. Although it does also end in a fight in a junkyard where there's a gigantic light in the sky. So please prepare yourself for that.
No, it does not. highly recommend it. And I look forward to you seeing it, Justin, so Brian and I can talk to you about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, oh my God. No, I can't wait. I can't wait to see it. Just been bouncing all over the place here in Florida, so I haven't gotten a chance.
Yeah, so in After Things, you want to give us your review of Galaxy's Edge?
Oh, I got takes, my man. I got
takes.
All right,
cool. Well, in that case, it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.